Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.
Sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host. Today I have the pleasure of having the author of Blowing Smoke, Rethinking the War on Drugs with Dr. Michael Resnicek, a provocative book that would change your way of thinking, the war on drugs. If you'd like to speak to Dr. Resnicek, please give us a call at 347-324-3460, 347-324-3460, or you can post your question in the chat room. I'm not going to read it on the air, or you can send a Twitter at #ApplecapitalGroup. Dr. Resnicek, thank you for joining the program this morning.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
I guess to begin with, kind of tell us your background. A lot of our listeners like to hear the personal view of someone tell us about themselves than versus reading something else. So if you don't mind, tell us about yourself, and then we just dive right into the book.
Sure. I'm a board-certified psychiatrist, and I do consulting work in the state of Washington. I've been a psychiatrist for about 23 years, and for the last 7 or 8 years, I've worked almost exclusively with inmates, prisoners on a forensic unit at a state hospital, and then for the last 4 years, I've been working in the state prison system. So I am on the front lines of the drug war, to say the least.
What got you to write this book? I mean, it's a really provocative view on the war on drugs, but kind of tell us your stance. How did you come to create this book?
Well, I began to see, starting in even medical school and before I did my psychiatry training, I began to see that a lot of what goes on in the field of medicine is highly politicized. That is, it's driven more by political needs than it is by science. And so I saw this especially to be the case in the arena of substance abuse. You know, in my training, I would read about the changes in the brain and how all these changes control human behavior. You know, it sets up this addictive cycle. And that all looks great, you know, from a scientific perspective. But when you're in the trenches actually working with substance abusers, you begin to see that they're, you see a totally different picture. Substance abusers aren't sort of the mindless, out-of-control people that the modern disease model of addictions would have you think. They're real people who, in many ways, live life recklessly, but they stop many times. They'll stop if their girlfriend demands it or they get locked up or if they're on probation. They'll stop until they find other opportunities. And so what this book is all about is to show that this whole disease model is wrongheaded. This does not accurately reflect human nature. Human nature is opportunistic, and we are missing the boat on how to control substance abuse. You know, we have two arms of the drug war. One is prohibition laws, and the other one is, you know, medical approaches to provide rehab and prevention services for addicts, and this is not working at all. And so I came up with a book that reviews the history of how we got here, how the disease model of substance abuse was developed. I look at the science behind the disease model, and I show that this is basically junk science, and what we're doing now reflects a kind of a unholy alliance between the medical profession and progressive politicians of the middle of last century to try to redefine human nature, redefine human behavior, and turn it into something that's been fully medicalized. And this is why we're not going to win the drug war this way.
Let's go back in time, for example. Go back 100 years when we didn't have these laws on the books itself. What happened during that time?
Okay. Good question.
How did we really cope as a society?
What happened was, prior to 1914, and that was when the Harrison Narcotic Act was passed. That was our first prohibition law. There were drug users, lots of drug users, but opium, heroin, cocaine, marijuana, amphetamines, these drugs were all legal. There were no regulations on them. And sure enough, some people misused them, but once we began to outlaw them, and the reason we started these prohibition laws has nothing to do with problems with drug use. And if you read the book, you'll see I trace this, and other people have written about this too. These drug laws were all about race baiting, trying to stigmatize minorities and immigrants. And we associated, officials in our federal government began to associate drugs with these groups, minorities and immigrants. Or these laws were passed to open up markets in China, for instance. And that's an interesting history. But it had nothing to do with problems with drugs, even though there were some problems. Some people misused drugs. But this is just like alcohol prohibition back then. And the temperance movement was also occurring at the same time. And what happened was you had all these progressives, and many of them were Christian progressives back then, getting up on their soapboxes, speaking about the evils of these things and how they were corrupting. You know, they were talking about how marijuana or cocaine used by Negroes in the South was corrupting them and causing them to commit sex crimes with white women. You know, that was kind of the hyperbole around this whole area.
So, wow, that's really amazing. Go ahead.
Yeah. So really what we have now is we have a problem with it, but and this is one of the big points I make in the book. The problem with it is that we have misconstrued human nature. And basically I say that the only way to control this problem is legalize all drugs for adults. And I know this is hard for people to hear. Legalize all drugs for adults, but hold drug users responsible for their own behavior. Right now, under the disease model, we enable these addicts. When people misuse, we scoop them up, we lay them in rehab, we give them welfare benefits, food stamps, even disability payments in many cases. And so we're basically enabling this problem. If we held drug users responsible for their own behavior, such that if they misuse it, they can't come running to us and have us bail them out. If we quit doing that, they would straighten up and start using responsibly if they're going to use it all.
Wow. So we take the European model, like Denmark and other countries that cope a little differently. If you take that model, I guess, as one extreme, how as a society those particular countries are surviving then versus in the States here, we can't handle it, or the Western world, we really can't really handle it?
Well,
or they fear that,
like,
we can't handle it.
Yeah, places like Amsterdam or Denmark and Portugal, for instance, have decriminalized drug use. And in some areas of Amsterdam, for instance, you know, everybody knows they have coffee shops where you can go in and it's legal to buy a little bit of marijuana and you can smoke it, you know, inside the little coffee shop or out on the patio, small amounts. And that's legal. And it's interesting, a few years ago, the Cato Institute came out with a study of drug use in Amsterdam, and it showed that they do not have out-of-control drug use but with marijuana, but they do have a lot less crime. Same way in Portugal, and this is what the Cato study was focused on. When Cato decriminalized all drugs, you know, it's still illegal to market and sell, so you still have some black market corruption, but drug use actually dropped once Portugal quit making a big deal about it and quit, you know, fomenting this forbidden fruit mentality about drugs. So actually, where it's been decriminalized, they're doing quite well.
You think it's just the perception of really fear? If we let the genie out of the bag, you know, America is a little different. The workplace is a little different. If we legalize it, I mean, it's like it's going to start an avalanche of issues that we've never seen before. In other countries, they have a better coping system than we do. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's the big fear. And, you know, everybody thinks about, well, what about the children? You know, if we legalize drugs for adults, it's just going to make everything more readily available for children. You know, I have a whole chapter in the book devoted to how to control drug use in children. It's radically different from what occurs now. What we have now does not work well because this whole issue of drug use has been professionalized or medicalized. I used to have parents bring their teens into my office after they've been caught with marijuana or cocaine, and they'll bring them into my office for an evaluation. The parents are all concerned because they're wondering if their child's addicted. And I said to them, said to the parents, well, okay, what have you done about this at home, in your home, about drug use? And many times they looked at me and said, well, I don't know, we're not doctors. And that kind of statement speaks to a big, big problem in our society. This whole issue has become professionalized. You have to take kids to the experts to control drugs, and parents many times feel powerless because they aren't doctors, and they think the medical approach is the only way to control this, and this is exactly wrong-headed. It's not what we should be doing. And so in my book, I have all kinds of techniques, how to structure the home, how to control drug use in children, and I basically am a big advocate of home drug testing. You don't need to take your child to the doctor. Randomly test them, especially when you think that they're out using. Test them and then totally take control of their lives. And with this kind of deprofessionalization approach, I guarantee you we can control drug use in children much better than we do today.
Wow. So if you, for example, you have that particular case that you have a parent coming in, the child was caught with some type of drug, what do you tell a parent how to handle that in your household? You know, I think we as Americans, we don't have our views a little bit differently, and we just scared to talk to our kids about anything. What do you tell that parent?
Well, I begin to talk to them that they hold the solution. They hold the keys for controlling drug use in their children, not the medical profession, not the rehab, down the street. They have the solution. And I basically say, you don't have to try to convince your kids not to use drugs. You tell them that if they use drugs, this is what's going to happen to them. And basically, you take them out of that drug subculture, that youth drug subculture, and you totally take charge of their life. You do not let them out of your sight. Whenever they go somewhere, you make sure it's in supervised activities. You might have to change schools, but you do and monitor the internet, take away their cell phone, take away the car keys. You totally take control of their lives. And in this chapter on children, childhood drug use, I give lots of recommendations on how that is done. One of my patients who's in the prison system here had a horrible, and all these guys, the men and women, have had horrible problems going back to their teen years with drugs. And now they're sitting in prison for horrible crimes they've done under the influence. And they look back and they tell me, and this one guy in particular said, you know, back then I was always being rescued and put into rehab as a teen. And he said, I didn't need to be rescued. I needed to be restrained. And that's exactly what parents need to do. You know, it's not complicated. You don't need a medical degree. You don't even need a counselor or physician to tell you how to do this. Just take charge and restrain your children from that drug subculture, and you'll save them.
Well, you know, I work in a congregation of a parish that has 3,000 families, and you hear the stories, you know, when you volunteer and you're exposed to a lot. You see the other side of a congregation that people can't control their children. I mean, they work. I mean, they're respectable citizens. They volunteer. They do all these things. Even when they cut back, they can't watch their child 24 hours a day. No, do you trust them to go to school? You don't know if they go to school, if you drop them off and you pick them up. Some said they have done that. And, you know, later in the day, the school don't call right away. But they'll call sometime later in the afternoon. Hey, Billy hasn't showed up to school yet. Haven't showed up for his class. Then it's almost time to pick them up. And then you pick them up. They're there. And it's just like, how can you control that kid, that child? I mean, this is pretty much across the board. It can be drugs and some other things. How can you control that child? You have to work. You have to earn their living. Or one parent has to really take off and just walk that child through the whole process. Or put them somewhere. Some of them have chance means, some not opportunities. some of them literally had to put them almost in a setting that they had to put them in an alternative school to make sure that they go into class, they're there and they can't get out. And then when it's time to get out, they're watching them. But it's like, and it makes the kid even more madder, and you're dealing with all these other emotions. Some parents are real strong. I mean, they're just threatened death and make the child believe it. Some of them just don't have that in them, and just feel like they're powerless. And with I'm just kind of describing two extremes. You have some that are real strong. They would do it. Some would take off and follow a child through the entire high school or middle school. Then some on the other end, you know, will put them in an alternative school and, you know, leave it at that, and then you're still with a hostile child. So,
yeah, I agree. This is a big problem. I think what needs to happen in some families is when you have rambunctious, risk-taking children, you really do have to sit on them. You really do have to totally monitor where they go. And so sometimes families need to downsize so that maybe one parent can stay at home or at least have a job where they're home, when the kids get out of school. There's lots of monitoring technology now where parents can keep track of their children. If they're going to give them a cell phone, you know, make sure they're monitoring who they're calling. And you know, with GPS locator software, you can find out where they're going with their phone, where they've been. You can put these monitoring devices in cars if your child has a car and you're paying for it, you know, to monitor where they go and how fast they go. And every time they break a limit, to have it text you. You can put computer monitoring software. Now, I know this sounds like, you know, the FBI, but I'm telling you, this is what you have to do to children. Like I said, you have to, you know, rambunctious teens who are prone to drug use, they're going to go there unless you restrain them. The single moms, and this is a big problem, single moms with rambunctious boys, you know, they're many times feeling powerless, and in fact, they are many times. And so what they need to do is get, you know, strong men involved in a boy's life, whether it's pastors, uncles, grandparents, strong male cousins. Listen, there's one thing kids respect, and it's power. And this is why so many young teenagers are drawn to gangs. Gangs have power, and there's discipline, and there's rules. And if you violate any of that, you're going to be disciplined. Kids love that kind of clarity. They love that kind of power. And that's why they're drawn to gangs. Well, you know, I think parents and pastors and youth authorities need to take a few lessons from gang leaders about how to control unruly behavior.
You're absolutely right. But, you know, there are huge consequences that is going to hurt. You know, then, you know, take that approach, okay, discipline itself. And if you took that approach and you have, you know, some moms that would just go off and, I mean, just then you get, you know, look at the extreme of it, then people calling child abuse. So it's like if you get on them too hard and they, you know, they scream child abuse and all of that, and then you end up, it's like a circle of something else. And it's like I'm thinking, some person, I think when we were dealing with a forum, said, you know, you do all these things that, you know, we have this child naturally, and then another person said, well, we adopt and look like we have Satan's spawn, and, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. Why we've been punished? We've done everything right. We've gone to school. We've done this and that. And it's like some of them feel like they're cursed. And, you know, even some to the point that there's so many rules in society, they say, well, you know, if we just really go off on this kid, you know, he screams abuse, we investigate it. And it's like a double-edged sword, and you have to walk this fine line. Do you have that particular problem in the past in your experience? With your practice, when parents are on that edge that we can't do things like we've done 40 years ago and physically, you know, discipline our child to a certain point, you know, you almost have to get on top of it. Gangs can do it and get away with it because that's a hidden society. But parents really can't.
Well, you're right. And if parents are losing it, if parents are screaming and getting over emotional about this, then they're going about it the wrong way. You know, I like Teddy Roosevelt's dictum, speak softly but carry a big stick. And parents do not have to lose control. They just tell their, you know, and I in this book, I talk to parents about how they should have some contracts, behavioral contracts, and spell out, beginning like in early junior high years, sixth or seventh grade, spell out what's acceptable behavior in this family and what is not, and then list consequences or rewards for good behavior, consequences for bad behavior. You know, put it up on the refrigerator so the kids know exactly what to expect. And then when they deliver on the consequences, parents can do it in a very controlled, soft-spoken manner. You know, Johnny, I'm so sorry you broke the rules here because now I have to deliver this consequence. I love you so much, but I have to come through with this consequence because we agreed this is what's going to happen. Kids understand that. If they know what the consequences are, you know, they'll know they deserve them. Kids aren't put off by that. They'll respect that kind of power and authority. So parents really need to be self-controlled. And again, I'm not saying it's going to be a bed of roses out there, but, you know, there are ways to restrain your children. And you know what? Parents should call the police if they have any problems, especially like single moms. If there's not enough powerful men in their lives, call the police. The police will come by and tell little Johnny he better obey his mother. The juvenile justice system is packed and overflowing. And if they can prevent some of this right in the home, they'll do it. And so I ask mom to get, I've done this before, call the police and have them come over and have a little talk with Johnny.
Oh, wow. In your experience as a psychiatrist, and what is it in the chemical in the brain itself that make people really addictive, if that makes sense?
Is it certain things in there?
Because some people can become addictive to certain things, some people can't. For example, alcohol. Some people come from alcoholic families, they might get addicted, but some might not. Some will come from alcoholic parents, but then one child will just drink. Another child, it doesn't really matter to him. He might pick up a drink once a year just for social. It's not something that he wants pleasure. Is there something in the brain that genetically or something within us that turns on, say, hey, I love this, like eating and blah, 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 and it turns you into this different person?
Well, I have a big discussion about changes in the brain and genetics and neurochemistry in the book,
mm-hmm.
and basically I show what is really known about this, and my take on it is that the biggest factor, the single biggest factor, is motivation. No, it doesn't matter how bad an addiction is; many people walk away from it, and when you compare those who walk away from it compared to those who don't, their brains are no different. And so then you have to conclude, as I have, that some people are finally more motivated than the others. And if you see somebody who's using drugs in an out-of-control way in their life, and they're still breathing and they still have a pulse in the morning, then they're being enabled somewhere, somehow, whether it's family members, whether it's the welfare system, or somewhere, they're being enabled. The fact that they can just use drugs all day long and have a comfortable place to sleep and meals in their stomach once in a while, they're being enabled. And my whole approach to this is, you want to help the substance abuser, you want to help those people who seem to be out of control, whose brains seem to be captivating them, then let them hit bottom and help them hit bottom. The sooner, the better. And what goes on in the brain is nothing more than what we see in any habit. When you practice a musical instrument, you change your brain. When you read and master a new field of study, you change your brain. When you use cocaine every day, you change your brain. When you quit doing those behaviors, your brain goes back to normal. So I present the habit model of substance abuse in this book, and basically the brain basically changes to the demands that we put on it. It constantly adapts to whatever we're demanding of our brain. And it's no different in substance abuse than it is with a musical instrument. So, you know, people think that, you know, the brain causes people to behave in certain ways. And that's not mm-hmm. true. What's really true is that people's behavior changes the brain.
Wow. In dealing with your experience on the opposite end, the extreme end, being in the prison system and being a psychiatrist there, the mentality of prisoners are totally different.
I'm not going to say they're hardwired. I mean, I volunteered with prison ministry. But you're talking about they have their way set, and they have a certain way of thinking. The effects of that is one extreme at being, you know, you went to prison because of a drug conviction. What's your experience in dealing with them and their particular stories? Why it had to go to that point?
Well, they went to that point because they wanted to. Again, the whole drug subculture that we've created with prohibition laws is a huge opportunistic society. These are people who use drugs a lot. They're outlaws, and there's a certain, you know, elan or narcissistic rush that comes with that, believe it or not. And these people, they become hardened. You know, this is the same thing that happened with alcohol prohibition back in the 1920s. People flouted the laws. They just, you know, had disrespect for all laws, and that's what everybody began to see that came from prohibition laws, because some people are going to use drugs regardless of what the law says. And so we've created this whole outlaw culture that fosters that kind of hardcore mentality. And while there are lots of people in prison for, you know, drug-related charges, most people are in prison for crimes committed in that whole outlaw culture. And we've cut these people off from respectable society and from cultural norms, and that's wrong. We need to bring them back in. That's why I say legalize drugs, and then let lay people make sure that anybody who uses drugs irresponsibly feels harsh consequences, because right now the professionalized approach does not do that.
Wow. Kind of tell us about, walk us through your book itself. Kind of tell us how, in your opinion, how it can give us some different insights of dealing with this war on drugs.
Well, the first third of the book, first few chapters, deal with the history of the disease model and the history of prohibition laws. You know, there was a 19th century disease model that was developed by the medical profession, but it never gained a foothold in society because of the more popular temperance movement, and also because that early disease model hooked up with the eugenics movement. And, you know, once you got onto eugenics, you were, you know, by the early part of, or the middle of last century, you were done, you know, as a movement. And then the middle part of the book, I look at the science behind the disease model, the genetics and neurotransmitters. And then I go into the last part of the book is my recommendations about what to do about it.
Wow. Now, if there is a book, I mean, for families who are experiencing this, can this book kind of walk them through the process on what they really can do to help them, help their families and help their child?
Yes. You know, I lay out some real practical suggestions about how to control children, especially in the arena of drugs. And, yeah, in fact, if they want a smaller version of this, I do have up on Amazon a small booklet, which is basically chapter 11 out of my book and some other useful appendices. And if they just want to sample a smaller version of this, they should go on Amazon and buy that.
Okay. And this book is available on Amazon and any other websites or?
I think it's on Barnes & Noble too, but Amazon for sure. It's just a small booklet that will address this issue just from the childhood end.
Okay. Okay. Anything you would like to leave us with regarding your book, and how also if they want to contact you, they contact you by your website, any other information you want to share to the audience?
Yes, I'd be happy if anybody has an interest in the book, they can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or they can go to my website, drrez.com, drrez.com. There's more information about the book. If you want to contact me and pose a question or give me your perspective on this, please do. There's a form there. You can email me. Yeah, I'd love to get some feedback. I'm doing three radio shows this week, and you know, we're just hitting the pavement, trying to to get this message out. I think parents and everybody needs to know that there's a lot of junk science out there, and we're paying the consequences for it in sort of the, you know, the decay of society. And I'm basically asking parents and lay people, you know, take back control of this problem.
Great. Well, thank you for coming on to the program. I really appreciate it. Well, the wealth of information. I will definitely check out your book and kind of share it with the church community to give them another perspective on how to handle certain things with youth ministry and the drug culture itself. Thank you. I really appreciate it, Dr. Wright.
Well, thank you, Tim, and it's been fun. Have a good day.
Great. Thank you. Take care. This
has been
another production of The Core Business Show. You can download this episode on iTunes or Blog Talk Radio or blog.applecavalgroup. Thank you for joining the program, and take care. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. For more information about equipment financing and asset-based loans, visit our website, applecapitalgroup.com. That's applecapitalgroup.com. Or call us at 866-611-7457. We hope you'll join us for our next episode. And remember, you can always get to The Core via iTunes. You'll find all our previous episodes there. And thanks again for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.